gotta slug you. Ugh! I've been kissed by a dog! I have dog germs! Get hot water! Get some disinfectant! Get some iodine!
Roses are red, violets are fine. You be the six, and I'll introduce you to the Stacking Benjamin Show. Hey everyone, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor Doug, and what a great day. I've got my cologne on just right, because coming down to the basement to talk couples and communication, the perfect Valentine's Day discussion, from Ramsey Solutions, we welcome Rachel Cruz. Also, to set the mood, we'll light a candle under some financial regulatory news out of Washington, D.C., gift a gem to a lucky caller on the Haven Lifeline, and still even have time for my candy-flavored trivia. And now, two guys who both drew the candy heart that said, "Go podcast," Joe and O-J-J-J-J-G.
Isn't that the most romantic?
Hubba hubba.
You remember that one?
Do you still get the Valentine's hearts?
I do. Now that the kids are gone, I do not.
I don't like them.
And I probably
get like a little box of like Whitman samplers or something, you know?
The one where it's like a minefield. You're hoping for the one that doesn't have any coconut.
The dark chocolate coconut is like the trifecta of nastiness with with almonds. It's like an almond joy. Ugh.
You know why that's bad? It's because it's good for you.
Yeah, right.
Hey, everybody, I am Joe Salci, I Average Joe Money on Twitter. And across the card table for our special Valentine's Day, pre-Valentine's Day episode, as it were, it is my partner here on the show, the one and only other guyers. We call him OG.
OG. That's me.
Man, Rachel Cruz coming down to the basement today. How great is
that? All right. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. She's going to talk about communication. And you and the Mrs. OG, great at communication. She tells you what to do. You do it immediately.
After rolling my eyes and grumbling to myself.
With your back turned to her.
Absolutely.
You will never do that to her face. But you know something you can do to her face? You can tell her to go to stackybenjamins.com/magnify money.
And I have told her to do that.
Does she listen?
For that, yes.
Absolutely. And you know what she's found? Is that when it comes to your checking account, your savings account, your money market, your credit cards, your debt strategy overall, auto loans, you name it. Guess what? Those ones that you have now, there's probably better ones out there. Magnify Money compares over 92% of the products that are available in all of those areas. And what's exciting is that you can shop between them all without having to even identify yourself. You just head to stackybenjamins.com/magnify money. Very quickly, you'll find out which product has the easiest to read fine print because you don't want much of that. They'll lay out the terms and what they like about it, what they don't like about it. Super easy. stackybenjamins.com/magnify money. I don't understand with places like Magnify Money, OG, why somebody just walks into a bank and says, "What do you got?" when from the comfort of home, you can get all the banks that you want in one spot.
And it's national, right? You put in your zip code, but you don't have to shop locally. You can have a bank in
much wider search. You know, yeah. And if you're looking to save money, refinance your debt, head to stackybenjamins.com/SOFI. They are the leader in marketplace lending. What does that mean? Over 225,000 people have refinanced debt with SoFi. How about that number? SoFi will help you finance your regular student loans, your parent or plus loans. They funded over $15 billion in loans to date. And listen to this. They've saved members over $1.45 billion with a B dollars. Our friend Dan Macklin at SoFi tells us it only takes a few minutes to find out how you can work with SoFi. So what are you waiting for? StackyBenjamins.com/SOFI. They don't only handle student loans, OG, but also personal loans. If you're consolidating the credit card debt, mortgages, they're giving you $100 if you use our link for your personal loan or student loan, StackyBenjamins.com/SOFI. Use that $100 toward the interest on the loan. Send it to your favorite podcaster. You know, they could send it in a Valentine's Day card to us. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes.
Miss Manners, I think, would be all about that. We did you this great service. You could just send us the $100 and we call it even. StackyBenjamins.com/ SOFI. One of those options is probably a good one. Maybe putting it toward the loan. The other one, maybe not so good. Hey, Rachel Cruz coming up talking about couples and money, but we have some very, when you think of romance, what do you think of? Oh, gee, I think of Washington, D.C. and rules and regulations, huh?
Mmm, yummy.
Let's hit the headlines.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our stacking Benjamin's headlines.
First headline comes to us from, I could say from everywhere, but comes to us from the Los Angeles Times. You know, on the show, just to preview this, we don't talk politics, but we do talk policy. Because when you're looking at your financial plan, we have to look at what elements of your financial plan are going to have to change as a result of legislation. So here's one. This headline says, Trump orders review of Dodd-Frank financial regulations, suspends retirement advisor rule. President Trump took a first step toward relaxing financial regulations last week, ordering agencies to review two key Obama-era measures that were designed to protect consumers and the nation's financial system, but have drawn the ire of Wall Street and Republican lawmakers. And calling for a review of the landmark Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act, as well as a separate rule that seeks to limit conflicts of interest by personal investment managers, the Trump administration's putting to the test whether it can meld the president's populist message with moves cheered by Wall Street. I don't want to talk about that dichotomy. Plenty of podcasts are going to talk about that. Let's talk about these two rules, because as we saw in our Facebook group, there's some, I guess, misinformation. Dodd-Frank has not yet gone away. His executive order, the president's executive order, the way I understand it, the way this reads, is to have the Treasury Secretary take a look at Dodd-Frank and recommend changes. It's just the first step. We have no idea how that rule is going to end up.
Right. And the same thing is true with the fiduciary rule, the DOL rule that you also referenced. I think there's some misinformation, kind of that initial thrust of data that came out a week ago or a little bit over a week ago when he was supposedly suspending it or something like that. There, upon further review, I think everybody's kind of backing off the it's suspended. And now it's saying, well, it's kind of the same thing, asking for it to be reviewed. Near as I can tell, all of the regulations that were slated to take effect the first part of April are still scheduled to do so.
You know, if I'm a betting man, I wouldn't bet on the fiduciary rule staying alive based on all of the commentary that I've heard.
See, I look at it completely different. I think it will. It just might be in a different format. I've never been a big fan of the Department of Labor taking ownership of this. It seemed like an inappropriate organization to be in charge of retirement advice. They kind of snuck their way in based on the ERISA rules and old 401k rules and said, well, that makes us in charge of it. Part of the problem is the fact that advisors, investment advisors, are regulated by two different other organizations, FINRA and the SEC, and now the Department of Labor. And the problem right now, as it is that not all of them all have the same rules.
So now we got three different intersections.
Yeah, it's almost like darned if you do, darned if you don't type of thing. If you do it the DOL way, you're in violation of an SEC rule. If you do it the SEC way, you're in violation of the DOL rule. Here's the good thing that's happened with all of this, though. All of these companies are already set up to run the DOL program. They've already invested tens of millions of dollars and globally hundreds of millions of dollars probably to adhere to these new Department of Labor regulations. And I don't see a lot of the companies backing off of that.
Isn't that funny that a lot of these companies whined and complained for so long that this was the wrong way to go? And now you're seeing them say, I think I might leave it the way it is.
Well, a lot of them are saying, well, this is better for the consumer, which I think is comical, right?
Which actually is our second headline. Nice segue, dude. Wait a segue into the next headline.
Truly, I have no idea what we're about to talk about, but it sounds like I do.
Comes to us from financialplanning.com. Ameriprise, the company I used to work with, will adjust, in quotes, if Trump delays fiduciary rule. After spending millions to revamp systems and procedures to prepare for the fiduciary rule, Ameriprise won't jettison months of effort should the regulation be overturned. That was CEO Jim Cracchiolo's message to analysts during an earnings call Thursday, a couple weeks ago Thursday now, by the way, when he sought to explain how the firm's efforts to comply with the rule will leave Ameriprise well-situated to compete with rivals in the future. And those efforts are not insignificant. To your point, OG, it says here, Ameriprise spent $11 million in the fourth quarter, the firm reported.
Yeah, $11 million bucks. So they're not going to walk back from that. And the changes that they've made are going to, you know, are all just designed around helping the consumer.
It's funny because this piece says that, of course, they're not the only company that you're seeing. Same thing you just said. In recent weeks, firms such as Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, and Advisor Group have made such declarations like Ameriprise did.
Yeah, LPL, Edward Jones, all of these companies have invested tons of money to get on board with the new plan.
The big change here, they say, that Ameriprise did, and I think this is the case of a lot of them, they're getting rid of a thing that a lot of individual investors don't know about called 12b1 fees that are inside of mutual funds. Tell us about 12b1 fees, OG.
Really, it's nothing more than a back-end sales commission. 12b1 fees are ongoing payments made to the broker-dealer for selling their product.
It really is a piece of the management. And when you say back-end, I mean, my understanding is it continues on. As long as you own this fund, don't you still pay a 12b1 fee if it was sold with a 12b1 fee? Yeah. And that's categorized as like an advertising fee, isn't it?
Something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Sales and distribution fee or something.
Right, right. So we all got sold on the 12b1 fee that didn't need to be there, apparently.
And weird, it's not there anymore and nobody's hurting.
No, so I think...
Well, maybe the people who used to get them as right. commissions are hurting.
Whoever that person is, the person that tabulated them and put them into the mix. I think the big lesson here, like the take home here is... Maybe the fiduciary rule lives, maybe the fiduciary rule dies, appears right now that it's probably going to die, right? But if the fiduciary rule does die, does it, with your personal financial picture, does it actually matter for you personally? I don't want to talk, obviously, as I said earlier, we don't talk politics on the show, but for you, can't you ask that question anyway? Like walk into your financial advisor's office and say, you fiduciary? Because that's important to me.
I think the biggest piece out of all of this is just the upfront nature of what is transpiring here. You know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about Edward Jones, for example, saying, we're not going to be fiduciaries. We're going to be brokers. This is what we do. This is what our firm is based on. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think sometimes we look at the other side of the equation and say, well, they must be bad if they don't have to. No, they're not bad. It's just a different way of operating. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as it's disclosed. You know, if you know, hey, this person's got to adhere to a best interest standards, or this person is, you know, more of a salesperson. So be it. It is what it is. It's just be upfront with the consumer about it.
Yeah, I think my take home is set your own family's regulations. Don't wait for regulations to start in Washington. Start them in your backyard.
Right.
Our next guest, OG, achieved number one on the New York Times bestseller list with her book, Smart Money, Smart Kids. She co-wrote with her dad, who you may have heard of, a guy named Dave Ramsey. You familiar with that guy? She is, of course, an American author, activist for financial literacy. She's spoken in public on numerous topics outside of relating kids and money, personal finance, how to avoid debt, how to save for purchasing a home. She, of course, speaks everywhere. She's been on Good Morning America, The Today Show, The Meredith Vieira Show, Katie, Good Day LA, Fox and Friends, been in The Wall Street Journal, Publishers Weekly. And now she's coming on down to the basement because what a great way to spend Valentine's Day learning how to communicate better with your spouse. So I'm so happy that she's coming down to talk with us about that before she hits the road on tour to talk about that in a few cities around America. Let's say hello to the one and only Rachel Cruz. And Rachel Cruz joins us in the basement. Have a seat. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm so glad that you made us a part of your tour, especially here around Valentine's Day, because so many couples, you know, Rachel, struggle to communicate when it comes to money. What are some of the biggest hangups you've seen people have?
Yeah, they do. And I think money is, it's just so emotional. I mean, it hits every part of our lives. And so I feel like people are extra cautious and sometimes even extra sensitive towards it. And so what I find too is that opposites attract. And so in a marriage or in a relationship, one of you is probably going to be a spender and one of you is going to be a saver. One of you is going to love doing a budget. One of you is not going to love to do a budget. And so those opposites really can butt heads a lot of times if there's not clear expectations and clear communication.
Well, we see that all the time. I mean, the saver wants to get the spender to the table. And the first thing they start doing, as you very well know, they start cajoling them, coercing them. And the more they do that, the more the spender kind of turns away and doesn't want to come to the table. How do we get these two people together?
Yes. Well, it's going to take a lot of work. So both need to know. Both parties have to be involved. And so what I say is let your strengths be your strengths. So if you're good at doing a budget and kind of figuring out, okay, here's where our money's going to go, and you enjoy that, then do that. That's your strength. So do the budget and then bring it to kind of the more the free spirit, if you will, and say, hey, here's our numbers. Here's what I was looking at. This is an idea of what we could do, where we could start. What do you think? And as a free spirit, you have to participate in the conversation. No longer can you say, oh, whatever you want to do, sweetie. No, you have to have an opinion. You have to look at the numbers and say, okay, this looks good. No, I spend more on food because I'm the one doing the grocery shopping. I know that's not right. And so really having this conversation, it's going to take a few times. It's actually going to take a couple of months, a couple of budgets to get this down. But it's amazing when you can agree on where your money's going. You agree on more than just money. I mean, you're agreeing on your goals in life, on your dreams, on your fears, where you want to go as a couple when you can agree on this. And so it's a huge part of not only lowering the stress and even the money fights in the relationship, but it just gives a clear path of, hey, here's where we're wanting to go. And this is the direction. This is our roadmap, which is the budget. And so the other thing is that both parties have to stick to it. So the spender has to be mature and say, no, I'm agreeing to this. I'm not going to run off to Target and spend $500, right? I'm going to stick to this budget. I'm going to say, okay, this is where our money's going. And same with the more of the nerd one that says, you know, I love doing a budget, but the nerds are usually better at keeping the budget than the free spirits.
Which side are you naturally on? I'm just curious about you, Rachel. Are you naturally a spender or naturally a saver? Are you more the nerd or are you more the free spirit?
Yeah, well, you can be both. So here's the deal. You can be a nerd, but be a spender.
All right.
Or you can be a free spirit and be a saver. So they mix and match these kind of two categories. But I'm actually a free spirit. I naturally do not gravitate towards the budget.
That's me too.
And I'm naturally a spender. So I'm the worst of the category, some would say. And my husband is more of the nerd. And he's the saver, which is so funny. So it's funny. I'm the one that teaches this stuff every day, right? And I'm the spender, but I am.
But that's cool because for people like you and I, because I'm totally a spender too, we have to create systems and surround ourselves with that person that's the opposite of us.
Absolutely. I mean, I always say that, you know, spenders, we have to have savers so that we actually have a life and that we, you know, don't retire broke. And the savers need us because we let them have a fun life, right? We open up the doors to so many fun opportunities because we have all these great ideas. So you need each other, and neither is right or wrong. Both is just different. I mean, the way you approach things is just different, but neither is right or wrong. Because I think some people put the label of the saver and the nerd as they're the good ones. And we're the bad ones. We're the rebels. Where I don't see that as the case. I think it's so how you're created and who you are, but you have to be mature and find a balance in both. Again, either if you are a spender or a saver, you need that balance of both.
Amen, sister. Well, you talk about communication and about having this ongoing discussion, I think, were the words that you used. How does it work? I mean, is it better to have a scheduled meeting? Is it better to put this on your calendar, like have it be part of a date night, or is it just an ongoing all the time discussion?
Well, your initial budget, quote unquote, meeting, you could say, needs to happen before the month begins. And so if we're in February and you haven't done one, then look towards March and say, okay, March, we're going to do our budget. And so that means we're going to need to do it toward the end of February. And we need to sit down together before March even begins. We're going to agree on where our money's going in March. And so that initial sit down meeting, yeah, it may need to be planned. I mean, depending on who you are, my husband and I, we live off of our calendars. I mean, we live and die by our calendars because we have so many moving parts of our family and travel and everything. And so we really do. We schedule out so many things. And one of them is that, hey, tonight we're going to talk about the budget. But then it's going to be an ebb and flow conversation throughout the month. Things are going to change. Maybe you say, gosh, we've gone out to eat so much more this month. So let's actually up our out to eat category, lower the grocery category. So you can change your category numbers throughout the month if you both agree on that, and that you obviously, you're not spending money you don't have. You have the money to actually spend and do that and, you know, adjust those categories. You're not going into debt for things. And so once you can agree on that and have that conversation throughout the month, things may change. But the initial budget meeting, depending on who you are, you may need to get it calendarized. Maybe it's a night out that you guys, you know, go to a restaurant, you sit down and look at your numbers, whatever it is, that initial meeting needs to be very, very intentional.
A candlelight romantic budget dinner.
Budget meeting. That's it.
Get a little Barry White playing in the background.
That's right. Watch a movie after. It's great.
We're talking zero sum, baby. Right.
That's right.
So I know a little bit about you, and I know that you don't think that allowances are just for kids either, that really in a marriage, you should also give each other kind of allowances to spend however you want. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah. So in the budget, you need to have a personal line item for each person. And what this does, it allows each person to have an amount of money that you say, hey, if I'm, you know, as a woman, I can speak for me. If I'm at Target, if I want to go get my nails done, get my hair cut, if I'm out and about, I have this cash. I have this allotted amount of money that I can spend as I need, versus every single purchase having to text Winston and be like, hey, I'm going to cut my hair. It's going to be $50. Are you cool with that? Like, you know, that just the over communication that's almost unnecessary is really eliminated. And it gives that person, you know, the freedom to say, okay, here's some money. I can spend it as I wish. And same with my husband, you know, if he goes into Home Depot or he does whatever he wants, he's like, okay, you know, I have some cash to spend. And so what that does is it also gives you kind of still your individuality. You know, you don't lose that when you get married. You definitely become one and you're unified in such a deep, deep way. But yet you're still going to have your passions, your own hobbies, your own interests, things that you like to spend money on. And so plan for that and just say, hey, here's the amount of money you have. Here's the amount of money I have. That way too, you know, again, you're not having to text each other with every little purchase, because that can get old very fast.
Well, I like that too, because, you know, I think sometimes people get judgmental about their partner and what they spend money on, and having that that allowance allows you to not have to play money cop with your spouse, which isn't your job.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, it's not that you're doing it in secret, right? I mean, if there's something obviously wrong that you're spending your money on or immoral, you know, obviously that needs to be communicated. But yeah, if Winston looks and he's like, Rachel, you spent $75 at Target, what'd you buy? And I'm like, couple of dresses and mascara. I don't know, you know, but I'm like, but I had the money. It was budgeted. I can do what I want. And so, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You may not understand each other's purchases 100%. And it's not done in secret. It's very much out in the open and talked about if needed. But yeah, it's there for you to spend, which is great.
Well, as part of this Valentine's episode, Rachel, a lot of people listening to this aren't married yet. Maybe they're dating. And at what point during the dating process do you say to this person, hey, let's talk about how you manage your money? Where does that come in? That's probably not first date material.
Yeah, right. Your first date, you probably want to ask, you know, how many credit cards do you have? How much student loan debt? What do you make? Yeah, that you'd probably be considered like the crazy money person. You know, I think it's like any other important conversation that you have in a relationship. As the relationship progresses and marriage is, you know, being talked about, and then in our future, you're naturally going to talk about in-laws. You're naturally going to talk about kids. Hopefully those conversations are happening, and money needs to be a part of that. And sometimes, you know, depending on who you are, certain subjects in regards to marriage is more scary, you know, more intimidating, and money may be one of those for you. So you may find it harder to kind of push that conversation and push into that. But I would encourage it so much, because the clearer you are before entering in a marriage about what your values are around money, if you are a spender, if you are a saver, and really how much debt do you have? How much are you bringing into the marriage? Those kind of things are so helpful. So that way there's no surprises, because one of the leading causes of divorce in America today is money fights and money problems. Right. And I always laugh. I heard an analogy where someone said, you know, what if the leading causes of divorce was bee stings? Well, everyone would probably be talking about bee stings, right? Like, how can we prevent it? What do we need to wear? You know, there'd be books written about it. I mean, everyone would be talking about it. Of the same intensity, kind of that idea needs to go with your money. Okay. It's a huge problem area for so many people. So how can you get past that? And really it's that communication and being on the same page in regards to your current financial state, but also where you want to go, what your goals are. Do you want to live debt-free? You know, what do those things look like for you and your hopes?
It's so exciting. Every time Cheryl and I have our money meeting, it just afterwards, it just feels so fantastic. And I feel like when we skip a meeting, Rachel, like it's like, I feel like we're not on the same page yet. When we have the meeting, like all week long, we have these very casual money discussions because we had the meeting, and it's fantastic stuff. You've got some cool date nights coming up. Speaking of Valentine's Day, I know you're doing this money and marriage tour.
I'm doing a money and marriage tour. So March 30th will be Minneapolis, April 12th will be Cincinnati, and May 11th will be Chicago. So I'll be there with Dr. Les Parrott, and it's all about money and marriage, a date night worth investing in. So we'll dive in deep to the topics we just talked about a little bit here on this podcast. And then Les Parrott, who's a marriage expert, he's brilliant and hilarious. He's so great. You know, he's going to really talk about what does your marriage look like? How can you get it in a healthier place, you know, with where you are now? So it's really exciting. And the events have already really exceeded our sales expectations already. I mean, people really are latching onto it. So it's really fun to know that we've kind of hit a nerve with this topic of money and marriage. So yeah, we'll be there, Minneapolis, Chicago, and Cincinnati.
There's a Valentine's Day gift right there, Rachel, buying tickets to that event.
Yes, absolutely. And you buy it as a couple. So that's, right. You know, the tickets are paired like that. And it is. And it sounds kind of corny and cheesy, but honestly, it's amazing. Just like you said that, you know, after you and your wife talk about money and you get done, you're like, okay, it's not as scary. It's not as intimidating as you think. And to be able to get really good practical tools to take back with you and help you win in these areas is huge. So you can go to rachelcruz.com and get your tickets there. And we're really excited about this event.
Okay. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you at least, I have to ask you one question about growing up with your father.
Yes.
Isn't that a prerequisite of every interview you do? They have to do
always,
that.
Always, always. But I love it. It's fine. I see it as a great thing. So.
So how strict was he, Rachel? Nobody listens to the show. So was he ever just downright mean about money, you know?
You know, it's so funny. I think people assume that we had like mutual fund parties growing up and like budget camps in the summer and all this. Thankfully, mom and dad, they really, truly, the honest truth is they did not hound us about money. I mean, we talked about it, sure. You know, as kids, we were expected to work. And then if we worked, we got paid. We were on commission system and we had to give, save, and spend some of that money. We had to save up for half of our car when we turned 16. I mean, there are definitely, you know, lessons to be learned throughout, you know, our different stages of life that they implemented, but it really wasn't this strict, crazy Dave Ramsey boot camp that you would probably assume.
That's so not the answer I was looking
for. Which I'm so glad, because Joe, I would be in counseling if that was my childhood. So I'm good.
That's right. But the other answer, Rachel, is far better radio. So I'm a little disappointed.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Right. Well, Rachel Cruz, thanks a ton for hanging out with us.
No, absolutely. Joe, thanks for having me on.
Hi, everyone. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and Rachel Cruz talked about how communication is the key to a healthy relationship. But as we all know, some people try to buy love, and Valentine's Day is the perfect time to bring out the wallet. Which leads to today's trivia question. How much money does the National Retail Federation expect consumers to spend, on average, for tomorrow's Day of Love? I'll be back with the answer and another handful of these chocolate-covered cherries in just a moment.
I'm so excited to have two sponsors that we really love that are super helpful to so many people. Our first is Magnify Money. Check them out at stackingbenjamins.com/magnify money. And if you're somebody like a lot of us that didn't get an education about money in school, well, guess what? Magnify Money will not only help you compare your checking, your savings, and your credit cards, they also have a graduate guide. What's a graduate guide? Well, Nick Clements, CEO of Magnify Money, told us what it's all about.
Right. Well, we went out and we pulled recent college graduates who were about 5 years out and said, what are your biggest regrets? And some of their biggest regrets were not handling their student loans right away when they got out of school, organizing them and finding out the best way to pay and manage that going forward. And another was just not learning enough about their personal finances. And so what we've done is, based upon the regrets of people who graduated 5 years ago, we put together a checklist so that as long as you follow that list, you at least will not have the regrets, the same regrets that these people have.
There it is. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/magnify money for you or the graduate in your life to get an education about getting their financial house in order. And if you've listened to the show before, you know I'm also excited about our second sponsor, SoFi. That's S-O-F-I. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi to check them out. And I've said in the past that you're not going to beat the interest rate on a student loan or on personal loans or mortgages outside of SoFi. However, I've also said you need a high credit score. What is a high credit score? And how does SoFi look at your credit? We asked Dan Macklin over at SoFi how it works.
So there's no absolute minimum that we have, but generally if you're in the 700s and above, then you have a great chance of being approved. But credit score is not the only thing we're looking for. There's a variety of measures, but it's one of them.
So even though it's not the only thing they look at. It's an important qualifier. So clean up your credit and then head to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi when you're ready to get your mortgage, refinance your debt through a personal loan, or look at those student loans to get the interest rate down to something more manageable.
Everyone, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. And before I get to your trivia answer, I just received a text from my ex-girlfriend, Janine, happens all the time, who said she wants to get back together. I know it's Valentine's Day, but I told her that I never really liked her. She kisses like Joe's mom's old poodle, and that she smells like somebody had the night sweats 2 hours after downing a double XL beef chalupa from Taco Bell. Of course, she took that the wrong way. She thought I was kidding. But let's get back to the love, shall we? Before the break, I asked how much money the National Retail Federation expects consumers to spend, on average, on Valentine's Day. The answer? The average person will try to buy their Valentine's love to a whopping tune of $146.84, which is a coincidence because after my massage, I just rounded up all the way to $150. Keep the change, sweetheart!
I have nothing to add there.
It sounds like you're buying about double the love the average Americans buy in their OG. You were over $300.
I didn't say that's my average. I just guessed.
That's the average.
I told you how much is the box of them little heart Whitman samplers that are all, and you try to find the one that's only chocolates and caramels.
Because you're going to end up eating them anyway.
Mrs. OG will eat them.
She'll have a couple.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, let's fire out the Haven Lifeline and tackle some of life's, or rather life insurance's, most important questions. Our friends over at Haven Life Insurance Agency, they are disrupting the life insurance industry by focusing on those two things that you value most, your family and your time. That's why they created the only affordable term life insurance policy you can purchase entirely online without a medical exam. Head to stackybenjamins.com/Haven Life now to learn more about life insurance the modern way. That's stackybenjamins.com/Haven Life. And you know, it's funny, OG, for those people that are super duper healthy. I mean, how much time does that cut off the clock, not having to do that medical exam?
Well, it's not only time out of the process, but it's time out of your day, right? It's, you don't have to get poked. Who likes to get blood drawn? Ugh.
No.
I pass out every time.
That's, can't imagine.
Usually it's from the vast amount of wine that I have right
ahead of time. Good. Because you're doing the fasting, so you got to have more wine.
You got to have some more wine.
Just to get the nutrients. Just to keep the nutrients.
Grapes.
I got it. Today we throw out the Haven Lifeline to our new friend, Tyler. Say hello, Tyler.
Hey, Joe and OJJG. How's it going? My question is actually related to Monday's show. I am going to open up a Roth IRA and I'm planning on maxing it out every year. And to keep it simple, I'm going to invest in commission-free ETFs and keep them very low cost. My question to you is, what is your guys' perspective on allocation in regards to indexing and ETFs? So after doing some research, I am thinking about doing about 40% in a total U.S. Stock market ETF, about 10% in a U.S. small cap, 20% in foreign. And then maybe the last 20% I would split between a REIT ETF and some sort of dividend index. That way I have some protection in case of a market downturn and I am just increasing my monthly yield that way. I'm wondering what you guys think, if I should just simplify it and just get, you know, three ETFs, if I should get a lot more granular with different sectors. And what your guys' thoughts are on the whole indexing portfolio. Love you guys' show, even though I hardly ever learn anything. Thank you.
Thanks for the question, Tyler. Great question. I'm trying to do Tyler's math. You're 10% off. But you
I figure the $550 is, that's like the wine fund. That's
right. He has that on the side. So as the market goes down, he can drown his sorrows.
Yeah.
I've got a couple
of thoughts and then I'm sure you'll chime in. A couple of things. Firstly, Tyler, you made some comment about, I want to protect myself from market downturns. My goodness, you could only hope during your accumulation phase that you experience lots of market downturns so that you can accumulate lots of different shares at low, low prices. So I wouldn't worry too much about, quote, protecting yourself from market downturns. I don't have any immediate thoughts about your allocation percentage. I don't think it's particularly bad. I don't think it's particularly good. It seems kind of run of the mill. But here are some facts. The way that we tend to think about investing money is we tend to have a little bit of a home bias, but we want to take the obligation of trying to guess which country or economy is going to do better out of the equation. To do that, what we do is we just look at where the world's GDP is allocated. And right now, about 55% is allocated to the US and the other 45% is international. And then from that, you know, that's where we're going to start making our decisions. And like I said, we're going to have a little bit more home bias than maybe straight down the 55-45 kind of line there. And by home bias, I mean we're going to invest more in the US than just 55% generally. But from an allocation standpoint, I don't particularly think it's too bad. Don't overthink it. You know, this is a set it and forget it type of thing. Put the money in every month and don't change it. Rebalance it once a year. Pick a day, your birthday, anniversary, dog's birthday, mom's birthday, Christmas, whatever you feel. And let it grow. Just don't fuss with it. That's going to be the hardest thing to do.
Yeah, I think Tyler's just starting off, I think this idea of dollar cost averaging is his friend, because especially if we do get a market downturn, I mean, he's putting money in every month, and that's such a great thing. So dollar cost averaging into it is far, far better for him if he's just starting out than worrying about, because you think about this, you know, let's say, and he doesn't want to do this. I understand this. Let's say he puts in $1,000 to start off with, right? Puts in $1,000, the market goes down 10%. He's going to lose $100. Now, you don't want to lose $100. I understand that. But if he loses $100 and later on his portfolio is worth, you know, $500,000 later on, I want to buy as many shares as I can cheap. So I'm forgetting about the $1,000 I'm putting out there. I'm not even playing that game because I know that the market's going to be way higher in the future than it is today. And dollar cost averaging is your buddy. If he can get on a monthly thing where he's putting money in every single month as that baby goes down, he doesn't have to market time, doesn't have to guess, you know, doesn't have to play the political game, doesn't have to think about any of that. How cool is that?
Yeah.
Doesn't have to pretend that, you know, he's Nostradamus. So,
yeah, I mean, I hate to even say this because I'm not a gigantic fan of them, although I will put an asterisk here that the Vanguard ones aren't too bad. You might even look at, you know, a really long dated target fund from Vanguard. They have a decent allocation, one fund. It's just a fund of funds, right? The things that I don't particularly care for, they do, but it makes it easy. One line item. I mean,
When you said simplify it, I thought, yes, why would you have, well, he's got four down here, but he's going to need five to get to 100%.
Well, how are you going to do? And that's the thing, right? What are you going to do? Buy five funds every single month with $458.33?
No. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Nope.
Go on Vanguard and look at those long, like the 2060s, the all equity ones, target date retirement funds. I can't believe I'm even saying this.
Dollar cost average into it.
Dollar cost. I mean, there are, if you tear it apart, they are five different Vanguard funds inside of it.
Right.
They just rolled into one. So that might even be easier.
Tyler, thanks for the question. If you've got a question for the Haven Lifeline, send it. See how easy it was for Tyler? Nice job, Tyler. Send that to this. This is where you go. You go on your browser and you put in stackingbenjamins.com/voicemail. That's stackingbenjamins.com/voicemail. People are also nice enough to write us letters. And we have a letter here from our new friend, Rob. Rob says, hey, Joe and OG, first off, need to say that I recently discovered your show and have really been enjoying it. Thanks for all the work you put into making it fun and helpful. Rob, we don't make it helpful. We do make it fun.
It's barely fun.
Tolerable. It'd be better if he said, thank you for making it tolerable. There's no doubt I'll have a significant impact on his life. Ooh. Oh,
Jesus. Yeah. It's pretty, I don't even know how to take that.
Rob's in a bad place, apparently.
I mean, I guess you're starting at zero and you go to a one.
Of course, he didn't say what type of impact we'd have on his life.
Yeah, you're going to have an impact. There you go.
I've said that to people before. You know, you're going to have an impact on my life. His question concerns switching from one S&P 500 fund to another. Two investing questions today. How about that? He's currently holding FUSVX. What's that one, OG?
It is a Fidelity S&P 500 index fund.
And I believe it's a class that is only purchasable at Fidelity, I think.
Yep.
He said he's switching brokerages. Yeah, here we go. From Fidelity to Interactive Brokers and hit a snag. IB, of course, can't hold FUSVX, this S&P 500 fund. So best he can tell, his only option is to liquidate, thus creating a taxable event. He said he'd like to keep growing these pre-tax gains, compounding interest, but wash sale rules don't seem to apply in the reverse. Do I have any other options? Thanks for the question. What do you think?
I'm confused. Did he say want to grow the pre-tax gains?
Well, what he's saying is he doesn't want to pay the tax. If he's going to move to another S&P 500 fund, he doesn't want to pay the tax to cash out of one, go into the other.
Then keep it where it is.
Then leave it at Fidelity. Yeah, but he said he's changing brokers. He didn't say why he's changing brokers. But
okay.
But
I mean, Fidelity's a decent company. I mean, I might be going out on a limb to say for somebody who's wanting to change from Interactive Brokers.
Let's say.
You don't like my answer.
No. Let's say that Fidelity has kicked him out for bad behavior. That sounds
That sounds more like something I would do.
Sounds like one of our listeners right there.
Yeah. Here's what I would do. I would call Fidelity and see if you can exchange it to a share class that is transferable. And that maybe just by doing that, there would end up being not a taxable event. Otherwise, is there anything else that you can do? No, you can pay the tax and then wait for some capital losses in the future to offset it if you get it this year. I don't know.
Here's my take, OG.
What do you think?
Yeah, if he doesn't have an extraordinary year where he's earned Ubers more money than he does in other years, he's just having an average year. What's so wrong with paying the tax now? I understand it's a skid and it's money that's not going to compound, you know, assuming that he was going to invest the money that he was going to pay the tax with. But if he pays some of the tax now, it makes it easier to move. The problem you and I see with people later on, they have these funds that really don't fit the allocation anymore, and they're afraid to sell them because of the fact that, well, I got this huge capital gain if I sell, and they end up letting the tax wagon, you know, run everything instead of dealing with their goal. All they think about is the tax. So,
well, we see this more with individual stocks, right? More than mutual funds, it's like, but I've been at ABC company forever, and that's why I've got all these stock options or all these shares that are at $1 a share cost. But I own $1 million worth or $250,000 or $100,000 or whatever. I think it'll all boil down to what we're talking about here. I mean, if he's got, you know, if it's a $10,000 position and it's gone up by 20% and he's got a $2,000 gain and you're talking about $350, it's not the end of the world. It's $350. I mean, if you got a $1.4 million position and now you're talking about a $70,000 tax bill or something like that, the only other option I can think of would be to inquire as to whether or not there's a different share class of this fund that Fidelity would do in exchange for you too, that is transferable. I would pay the tax bill, right? And just, I mean, we're looking at it here.
I don't think the tax bill is the worst thing in the world at all.
No, I mean, the fund's up 24.5% for the year. I'm sorry, in the last 1 year, right? So my guess is it might be out of balance in your position or in your portfolio. So maybe it's time to
sell some of it,
rebalance anyway.
Yeah. Not the worst thing in the world.
Or just keep it with Fidelity.
I understand where he's coming from. Why pay the tax if you're not going to spend the money today? But if he does, it makes it easier to sell it later on because he doesn't have this big, huge problem down the road. So it's the same thing with annuities. I don't want to just uncover, you know, get into too many different things. But I mean, you and I both met people that own annuities and they're like, oh, I can't sell my annuity. Why?
Just did that last week.
Because I've got all this money that I'm going to have to pay tax on. Yep. Why'd you buy the annuity in the first place? Did you buy it to not spend it or did you buy it to spend it? And boy, it creates tax. Don't create a tax trap. Mom always says that. Don't create a tax trap. Yes. Thanks for the question, Rob. If you've got a letter, letters are getting a little backed up again, which is nice to see. In fact, it's nice to see to the point that we're going to, after our break next week, which for those of you that are new to the show, we have 8 weeks of shows. And then we have a week where Griffin, the intern, comes down here and he plays some of the best of the past Stacking Benjamin shows while OG and I go get some ice cream for the week.
I like that plan.
Yep.
You buying?
Escape the basement this time because you bought the last 3 times in a row. So I think it's my turn. And I have to say, by the way, if you've got a letter, send those to me, joe@stackybenjamins.com. Or either way, I'll tell you what you can do. If you head to stackybenjamins.com and go to the About the Show page, you'll see if you hover over About the Show, a drop-down menu will come down, go to Contact, and you'll see a link there for the Haven Lifeline. You'll also see a link there where you can ask us questions. Kathleen, our business partner, made it super easy for everybody lately. Thanks to Kathleen for doing that. If you've got a question that is something you need to talk about in private, you need better financial planning in your corner. Talked about this earlier, OG. Are you a fiduciary?
Yes.
See, that was easy. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/OG, the letter O, the letter G, and that will lead you to OG's calendar where you can set up your virtual meeting with OG to talk to him in private about your financial situation and see what it takes to get OG in your corner. All right, that's going to do it for today. Big thanks again to Rachel Cruz for coming down to the basement. How awesome is that? Thanks a ton to Rachel. And I was disappointed there at the end, OG, when she was telling me that growing up with Dave Ramsey as a dad, he wasn't quite the taskmaster that you expected.
Like, oh, yeah? He's a pushover?
Well, you heard. She didn't say that. But there were no, like, you know, rapping your knuckles because you wasted a dime or something, which is, that's the story we all want, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, oh, well, a little disappointed in Rachel there. But anyway, thanks to Rachel for coming.
It still worked out.
Yeah, it did still work out. Thanks to everybody who's told friends about us or left a review of the show. You know, reviews are how people find out about what the show's all about. Love this. It's a 5-star review from Anson28. This one's going on Mom's Fridge. Says, ha, this is a fun podcast and I really enjoy listening. I've reached a point in my life where listening to Slipknot while driving around gets me nowhere. I've been listening for the past few weeks and this has been very insightful on so many subjects. I've already begun to pick up better habits. My mind is continuously running throughout the day on how I can better myself. It's fun to hear from all the different guests to include difference of opinions, even if it's in relation to Star Wars. Thanks. Thank you guys. Keep them coming. See how easy that was? It was fantastic. Thank you for the review. Also, a great review here from MacFan199999. Said, we had a great French lesson. Said, hilariously funny segment on French lesson. Were you trying to be funny with it? We're trying to teach people important phrases in French, yeah. OG.
But I stuffed my gold in your doomsday bunker.
If you know what I mean. Here on Valentine's Day, right? All right, everybody. Go have a happy Valentine's Day tomorrow. And Doug, what should we have learned today?
So what did we learn today? Well, first, Rachel Cruz nailed it. Communication is the key to a healthy budget and, better yet, a healthy relationship. Here's a Valentine's Day question. What are you going to do to improve your communication about money? Second, the fiduciary rule? Sure, it's probably dead, but that doesn't mean that you can't ask your advisors if they're working as your fiduciary. Make sure you see that in writing. But the big lesson? Don't tell your ex-girlfriend exactly what's on your mind unless you want to know what's on hers. Apparently, she thinks my breath smells like mixed with an overdose of donkey sounds like somebody's still got a crush on me. I'm going to give her a call. A big thank you to Rachel Cruz. You can find out more about Rachel Cruz and her book, Love Your Life, Not Theirs, at the aptly named rachelcruz.com or through our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. This show is the property of SB Podcasts, LLC. The show is created by Joe Saul Sehi, produced by Richie Rutter Reese, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remuneration. There's no way you would take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only, and before making any financial moves, consult with a real financial advisor. Special thanks to my ex-girlfriend Janine for agreeing to get together again, and it sounds like it's going to be someplace dark and romantic. She said, point blank when I called, that I could go someplace where the sun don't shine. Romance is in the air.
Welcome to the after show. This is the part of the show that doesn't exist. What happens in the after show stays in the after show. I'm a little late for another meeting, OG, but I'm just going to type to this guy. So if people hear typing in the background, it's because our taping's running a little long and I have another meeting. But we've got some important work to do here first before we say bye-bye.
I have a question for everybody who's still hanging out. I'm trying to decide what to do about this little problem. I'll try to talk through it pretty quickly. So about 2 years ago, not quite, a year and a half ago, Mrs. OG was in a pretty healthy accident on the highway. Not her fault. Everybody was fine. In fact, surprisingly, everybody was uninjured in the accident. Usual process, right? You call the insurance company, they want the police report, they come out and do the inspection on the vehicle. And then they came back with, hey, we're going to fix it, which is surprising because it was a pretty old vehicle, right? And I said, well,
but that's good news.
Kind of. I mean, it was a give and a take, right? I mean, I kind of wanted it fixed,
right?
Because then I didn't have to buy a new car.
Right.
But I also didn't want it fixed because it was now pretty tore up, right? I mean, yeah. And every time, you know, the value of the vehicle goes down tremendously after a pretty healthy accident. So in any event, we went round and round on this, and the long and the short of it was the insurance company appraised it at about $18,000 compared to all cars.com, autotrader.com, car lots, all of them were about $12,000.
Cha-ching.
Right? Now, the repair was $10,000. And so they have this kind of ratio is around about 60%. If they got to write a check for more than 60% of the value, they usually just say, we're going to total it out.
I was going to say, man, that was so close.
Yeah, it's certainly close. And so we went back and forth with them on it. Like, no, the thing's worth 12. Just cut us a check for 12 and call it a day. Right? They didn't do it. So we're going to fix it. Then the repairs cost more than they thought. Ha, 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 ha. Right? Years have gone by, year and a half. And as I mentioned a couple of months ago or a month and a half ago, we picked up a new family roadster for the ever-growing family. And so I go to CarMax to sell the old vehicle, right? Guy runs it through its paces and says, this thing's, well, it's in decently good shape, looks nice on the outside, but you know, it's got some miles on it. I said, well, yeah, it's a paid-for car that's 8 years old. Of course, it's going to have some miles on it. Yeah, the leather looks pretty worn. That's weird. 125,000 miles of sitting in them seats. That's a lot of sitting, you know? And he says, well, and then in the, you know, with the salvage factor on it, and I'm like, excuse me? He says, well, the car's been salvaged, so it's really only, it's only worth scrap metal.
Dick, what?
Yeah.
You wanted them to total it and they didn't.
So the insurance company did.
The insurance company totaled it. But they told you they didn't total it.
Yes.
So they put on they put on the report that they did total it.
Yes.
And they fixed the car.
Yeah. And so, you know, so I talked to the guy at the dealership there and I said, well, how do we get this fixed? It's obviously a mistake. It's not, you know, I never got a new title or anything like that. He says, it's not fixable. This is it's on the national database so that when people type in the VIN of this car, it's for your protection, right? It's so when you type in the VIN, it says, you know, car was in major accident. You go, oh, okay, geez, you know, I pay accordingly. So I called the insurance company. I talked to him and I said, I think you guys screwed me on this. I think somebody owes me a check for, I don't know, 18 grand because that's what you said it was worth, right? Oh, and P.S., there's also been about $5,000 of repairs in the last year and a half on this thing that I wouldn't have had if I wouldn't have had the car. So I'm kind of curious if anybody's run into anything like that in our listening audience and what they did about it. My opinion of the matter is I've got more time than I think the auto insurance company does. And I'm not going to throw them under the bus right now on the show, but I will. I'll be happy to do an entire show about do not buy auto insurance from insert company here.
But have they gotten back to you since you said that?
No. So I called, give and take? I called and I talked to the insurance adjuster and I said, you're the only phone number I have.
Because they're not being mean yet. I mean,
not quite. So it was 2.5 weeks ago.
Oh, that's been a long time.
Yeah, right. So I explained it all to her, gave her the claim number. I said, you're going to remember me as soon as you look at this claim. She looks there, she goes, I remember you now. I said, I mean, it was just a pain in the butt. The repair took 4 months. I mean, it was really, really, really long repair. And there are all sorts of other problems with it. But nevertheless, I said, listen, here's what's, you know, got to happen. I need a check because I need a check. That's the only solution I can see that works on here. Well, I emailed her at the 2-week mark and said, I haven't heard anything from you. not a word from it, no letters, no texts, no emails. Hey, we're working on it. We're trying to come up with a resolution. And I said, so I can only assume that the insurance company has no interest in solving this amicably. I filed a complaint on the Department of Insurance website last night already. So I think that'll be a shot across the bow. But
just because they now are your persona non grata.
I think so.
Just ignoring
the other plan that I have is there's a little hail damage on the vehicle. My other plan would be to repair the hail damage. Like just call them and go, yeah, I need a claim, make a claim. You know, because my deductible is what, $1,000 on that? Which is fine. But I'll pay $1,000 to make them pay $5,000.
You still don't know that they're going to do that.
Well, no, the hail damage, I mean, that's just a normal claim, right?
No, but what I'm saying is you don't know that they'll pay the you're saying if you do that, they'll come around and pay the other one?
No. I'm just saying, you know, you want to mess with me on this? Stand by.
I'm going to mess with you
I got more time than you. You know, and I figure the lawyers are $1,000 an hour. So maybe I'll just throw it in court. Small claims court for $10,000. I'll just, you know, Your Honor, I was wrongly victimized by this big, mean insurance company. I got to send somebody to the courthouse, right? Otherwise, I win. What do you think?
More to come.
So anybody has any opinions on this, I'm happy to converse. OG@stackingbenjamins.com is my email address. If anybody's had something similar, what they did, what they didn't do, what they learned, be helpful.
Yeah, that would be. All right. We'll see everybody back here Wednesday.